Live from the University of Texas at Austin, the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the Department of Government present Introduction to American Government with your professors, Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel.
I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for Introduction to American Government.
Todd outside. So, you know, you guys are in week two in the news. Professor McDaniel and I just wanted to reinforce or reiterate, since we're starting to have module assignments and get the gist web text assignments due, pay attention to your syllabus, consult your syllabus. It's got all of the due dates, all of the due times. Don't be caught by surprise, be caught off guard. There's no excuse for being caught off guard by one of the due dates or anything like that. So pay attention to your syllabus. That's your Bible. If for some reason you're not sure about something, consult your syllabus, but then ping us and we're happy to put you on the right path. Okay, so with that, week two in the news. Now, next week, there's going to be some Democratic primary debates. So next week, our focus will be trying to clarify this group of 24 individuals, and you know, we'll comment on that. But this week, we figured you know, we'll put off our inclination to talk about national electoral politics for a week. There are some big things going on right now. We're going to talk about something going on in the Congress. That is, Robert Mueller is going to testify on Wednesday in front of the Congress, mostly at the behest of Democrats. We'll talk about that. Do a little foreign policy discussion. Professor McDaniel and I were thinking things are kind of mounting up in Hong Kong and Puerto Rico and Iran, and we're going to kind of talk real briefly about those situations. And we're going to bring it back again to Texas. We're actually going to talk a little bit of electoral politics, but reference to Texas. And Professor McDaniel wants to hit on Big Pharma because, you know, he likes to talk to the man when he can.
So, that's right.
That's right. All right. So let's start with the Mueller testimony in front of Congress. So this allows us to revisit something that occupied all of our attention, those of us with politics, for the last year and a half since the Trump administration, you know, took the oaths of office back in January of 2019. There have been questions, lingering questions, about what went on in the 2016 campaign, Russian involvement in that campaign. Did the Trump campaign coordinate with the Russians? And, you know, so the Mueller investigations, what happened, for those of you who have sort of forgotten about this, and God bless you for moving on, was that, you know, the Trump campaign was accused of coordinating with the Russians. And it wasn't clear, you know, so when I say coordinating, everybody knows the Russians were messing with our election systems. You know, they were trying to influence, they were sort of spreading information via a variety of different sources and formats, trying to, you know, kind of sow discord. Now, this isn't kind of endemic just to the United States. The Russians do this all over the place. And, you know, to be fair, America has a history of kind of monkeying with elections historically, less so recently, obviously. So it's not like our hands are totally clean on this. But the notion that a foreign power would be using kind of modern tech to try to disseminate false information and potentially influence elections is something that's very concerning to Americans. So that part of it, you know, there's bipartisan support. Both Republicans and Democrats think that that's something we need to figure out exactly what went on. But a byproduct of that was, as the Russians were trying to monkey with our elections in 2016, did high-level or even low-level members of the Trump campaign kind of facilitate that? Were they open to the Russians coming in? And in particular, the specific charges were the Russian agents, you know, claim they had information about Hillary Clinton. Did they meet with representatives of the Trump campaign? And if so, you know, does that constitute some sort of very serious breach, not just a protocol, but, you know, essentially breach of law, like criminal activity? So the Mueller was a special investigator, was tasked by the Congress, by the Department of, actually not by the Congress, I should be clear, by the Department of Justice to investigate this. So typically when there's a scandal involving a specific administration, the executive branch, because the Department of Justice has appointees named by the president, oftentimes the Department of Justice will pass off the investigation to a special investigator or a special counsel. There's a small difference between the two, but in the Mueller case, it's a special investigator. And the investigator has most of the time kind of unlimited powers to seek out information and to chase down leads and to put together a report which is presented to the Department of Justice and then presented to the United States Congress. So Mueller was appointed special investigator and spent a year and a half,
something like that. Yeah, it was a good amount of time.
Yeah, collecting information about what went on in 2016 with the Russians and the particular, the real sort of money thing, especially for Democrats who've cast a suspicious eye on Trump since the outset, was whether in fact there was coordination between the Russians, collusion, of course, is the magic word, between the Russians and the Trump campaign. So the Mueller report came out and it didn't particularly satisfy anybody. The Trump administration came out, Trump in particular came out and said, complete exoneration, no collusion. That was kind of the tweets and the taglines. And the Democrats said, no, that's not what he said. And in fact, the truth lies somewhere in between. What the Mueller report said was, we don't find sufficient, evidence of collusion to recommend any particular criminal indictments or things like that. We also, investigated obstruction of justice. We're basically kind of taking a pass on that. We're going to kick that over to the Department of Justice. Here's kind of what we have, right? So the Republicans, defenders of the Trump administration, said no collusion. This thing exonerates the president. Although specifically in the report, it says we do not exonerate the president. We're just not recommending criminal charges against individuals involved in the situation. And the Democrats said, well, and this is a key. This is key to what you guys are going to see in the next few days. The Democrats said, well, the key part of the Mueller report was that the Department of Justice had already issued an opinion that said, we don't believe you can indict a sitting president. And so under those, the Democrats say, well, look, under those sorts of guidelines, of course the Mueller report isn't going to recommend indicting a sitting president. So there's a question. One of the things you're going to hear as you guys pay attention to this testimony is Democrats are going to pointedly ask Mueller if that advisory comment had not been issued by the Department of Justice, what then? In other words, is the notion that you're not recommending any kind of indictment or criminal charges, is that contingent upon DOJ's advisory comment about whether a president can be indicted while he or she is serving in office? So for our purposes, the class on American government, that's a critical opinion, right? I mean, this is really sort of a fascinating test case while you guys are learning about American government. That is, you have an executive branch. The executive branch includes the Department of Justice, the special counsel, special prosecutor, special investigator, I should say. Sorry, I was trying to be clear in my choice of words here, is something that is appointed to try to avoid conflict of interest. It's extra constitutional. That is, it's not something that's provided for in the Constitution. So you all should be clear on that. It's kind of an invention on the part of the executive branch to give, to avoid the appearance of conflicts of interest. Although, as you guys have probably seen from the news, everybody still thinks there are conflicts of interest going on here, there, and everywhere. Mueller has said, so you might ask, well, what's Congress doing? Well, Congress has the power of oversight, and Congress thinks that it is appropriate to bring the special investigator, special counsel, to testify in front of Congress, although Mueller has already said, I'm not going to say anything beyond what is in the report. I think what the Democrats would like to do is get him to, there wasn't a lot of traction on the report. The report is long. Have you read it? I haven't read it. Have you read it?
Is it fully public yet? I know it's been.
No, there's a redacted version.
Yeah.
The Attorney General of the United States, Robert Barr, has basically issued a version of the report. It's lightly redacted. I actually have seen about 100 pages of it. And what's been redacted is that anybody who's mentioned in the report who is not indicted, and basically nobody was indicted, is protected. The Attorney General's office says we're not going to put people out there and name names when there's no accusations of criminal activity. So those names have been redacted from the report, which is a source of controversy. So Congress would like him to get in front of the public. The Democrats would like to keep this sort of issue alive and kind of recast it a little bit. Also, there's some Democrats who just want to ask for more information with an eye towards, do we want to move forward with this thing? There's not only the question of collusion, which the report mostly addresses. And, you know, the preponderance of opinion is that, you know, there's no direct evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. But that doesn't mean there's no evidence. It means there's no direct evidence upon which you could base an indictment. But there's still the question of obstruction of justice, and Mueller has been sort of forthcoming in saying that he disagreed with the Attorney General's interpretation or casting of the report as saying that there's no obstruction of justice. There is a question, Professor McDaniel and I have talked about this a lot as we've discussed this issue. From a legal point of view, if you are not accusing somebody of a crime, in other words, there's no finding of criminal activity, it's very difficult to bring obstruction of justice charges, because obstruction of justice demands that someone has knowledge of a crime and works to prevent forces of justice from actually dealing with that crime, investigating it and prosecuting it. So if there's no crime, it's difficult to prove obstruction of justice. I think that's been kind of the Department of Justice's take on this and why they haven't gone after Trump or members of the administration, because, you know, Trump and people involved in the administration were more or less forthcoming as this thing kind of went on. And I think that Mueller wasn't real pleased with the way some people acted. But again, if you're not indicting anybody for a crime, it's very difficult from a legal point of view to do obstruction of justice. And I think that's kind of the explanation. But at any rate, the Democratic majority, they took the majority back in 2018. You know, Nancy Pelosi took the gavel back in 2019 when they were all sworn in. They want a little more on this. Republicans, from their point of view, I think are going to talk about things like, hey, where did you get this information in the first place, and why were you going after Trump, which wasn't necessarily the focal point of the Mueller report, but Republicans believe, and there's some evidence, that a lot of the stuff that came up that led the FBI to kind of go after the Trump people came from dossiers that were prepared by the Clinton campaign or by people were hired by the Clinton campaign, and they want to know, well, wait a sec, what's the government doing using those as the basis for spying on a presidential campaign in an election year? So Republicans have their partisan interests in this thing. Democrats have their partisan interests. That's not to say that there's not legitimate issues here, but politics is ever present. So that's as quick as I could do that. I apologize for that. Professor McDaniel, what do you got for us on this one?
The most that's going to really come out of this is going to be symbolic. So while the Democrats are in control of the House, for the most part, it's really going to be symbolic. There's nothing substantive they can actually do. There have been calls for impeachment. So, for instance, Representative Al Green from who represents Houston put forth articles of impeachment, only for that to be struck down or knocked down.
That was last week, wasn't it?
Last week.
And so, yeah, they actually had a vote on moving forward with that, and it didn't get much support. What did it have, like 80?
Yeah, it didn't go very far
at all. 435.
So. And again, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, look, I'm not going to go after impeachment because impeachment is a very risky thing. Many of you weren't alive when this happened, but if you think about when President Clinton was impeached, it kind of blew up in the face of Republicans. And so it's something you don't really want to do because, again, in many ways it becomes kind of a bit of a circus and you can quickly lose control of it. Furthermore, even if the president is impeached by the House, he's next to the Senate, and the Senate it's not going to make it through the Senate. And so, again, the idea of an impeachment is, you know, you're impeached by the House, the Senate, then there's a trial. It won't get that far.
So constitutionally, the House can vote to impeach, and all it takes is a majority of the House to impeach the president. But that simply means that the case is remanded to the Senate for trial, and the Senate votes on whether to remove the president from office based on the articles of impeachment. And it's actually kind of an interesting constitution. People keep talking about constitutional crises and stuff like this. It's not a constitutional crisis. It's laid out in the Constitution. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, would preside over the trial in the Senate. So it's very interesting. This did happen in the 90s with Bill Clinton. The House voted to impeach, had four articles of impeachment. I think it was four. Yeah. Went to the Senate, and the Senate voted not to remove from office. And William Rehnquist, the Chief Justice, presided over that. By the way, William Rehnquist, who looked like he wanted to be anywhere else in the universe besides presiding over that Clinton trial. Mm-hmm. And as Professor McDaniel said, this was in 1998. In the 1998 elections, the Republicans got beat Usually the president's party loses seats. The president's party gained seats in the 1998 midterm elections, largely because people thought the Republicans had overreached.
Yeah.
Right? And so right now, I think Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are really, you know, kind of putting the finger to the wind and saying, like, we're not going to do this if we think it's going to cost us the 2020 elections.
Yeah.
And it's not clear whether there's much public sentiment to impeach Trump, certainly for these particular charges. But
yeah, it's a nice catchphrase for people to use, but they've used it with President Bush. They used it with Obama. It's like, oh, impeach. Everybody keeps yelling it. It's a nice catchphrase, but it's not going to happen. It's very difficult. Furthermore, the amount of collateral damage to the parties, but then also the international stage. Like the one thing I remember about the Clinton impeachment is I thought, like, finally, I went to South Africa for a month and I was like, okay, whoo, I'm in South Africa. I can finally quit hearing about this. There are really only two things being talked about. Sammy Sosa, Mark McGuire, and the impeachment process. Oh, and Viagra.
The 90s were great.
Yeah, and Viagra and Rogaine had just come out. I remember being in a car in South Africa, and guess what? I got to hear about the Monica Lewinsky issue. I'm like, can I not get away from this? It is a huge embarrassment nationally. And so it's, again, it provides a great deal of instability for the nation. And so there's a huge cost associated with this. Right. Impeachment sounds great, but it's not going to happen. People get all upset because why won't you go through with the impeachment? It's because there is a cost associated with this. And are you willing to pay that cost? And most people aren't, because it is a very huge cost.
Well, in terms of the timing, you know, the Nixon impeachment, Nixon was not impeached, by the way. He resigned before he would have been impeached almost certainly by the House, and then probably removed in the Senate. But he resigned before that happened, right? So Andrew Johnson was impeached in the 1860s when he took over from Lincoln by Republicans who wanted him to take a harder line against the South during Reconstruction. So in both the Johnson and the Clinton situations, you know, there was a lot of politics, surprise, surprise, going on. Right now, I'd look at the calendar, right? I mean, if you're a Democrat and you want to beat Trump, beat him in the 2020 election, right? So in that sense, I think what they'd like is sort of information to come out which allows them to weaponize this issue for 2020. But are you going to impeach him before the 2020 election and then suffer the consequences? And if he wins re-election in 2020, well, you're not going to impeach him then, because then you've got, you know, a re-elected president and the public has spoken. Then it looks like you're just trying to undermine democratic processes. So I think Professor McDaniel and I, now, we've been wrong before, and if there's a revelation, hey, all bets are off. But, you know, I think that ship has sailed slightly. So you mentioned foreign policy, you mentioned South Africa. Let's talk briefly foreign policy. I just noted over the weekend, Hong Kong protests, the Puerto Rico protests, and the standoff with the Iranians, which has expanded to include the British now. But, you know, these are all kind of interesting episodes on the international scale. I just to cover the logistics real quick, in the Hong Kong protests, Professor McDaniel reminded me before class, I'm like, God, why are they protesting again? And it's a change in the, I don't know if it's in the law, I think it probably in the law, but Hong Kong was an independent territory for years and years. The British actually leased Hong Kong from the Chinese.
From 1999.
1999, that lease ran out, and so control of Hong Kong reverted to China. When I was back in your position, back in the, you know, as an undergraduate, Hong Kong is one of the four tigers. They used to talk about the four tigers, these Asian locations. So it's Hong Kong, South Korea, Shanghai, and what was the fourth? I can't remember the fourth. But they were these economic whirlwinds that operated in, you know, a part of the world where China loomed and Vietnam and other communist countries loomed as pretty kind of intimidating presences. So when Hong Kong reverted back to China, people were very concerned, and what's going to happen? And China's policy has basically been, hey, you guys just keep making money.
Yeah.
We're quite happy with that. But the change in the law was that people who were accused of crimes in Hong Kong would be extradited to mainland China. And that's what has prompted these protests. So when you watch the footage of people in the streets, there's, again, this concern that it's an attempt by the government to reassert control over a part of China that has a very strong independence streak that's been nurtured through economic development, right?
Yes. So, I mean, they see themselves as very distinct from China, and so it is seen as kind of an incursion on the part of the Chinese government. Even though they are under the Chinese government, they still understand themselves as independent, like, no, we're distinct from the Chinese government. And so you're seeing this very strong reaction. And that was really one of the major concerns of how would the citizens of Hong Kong react to becoming, to basically coming under the Chinese government. And, you know, this is a clear example of it not going well at all.
Yeah. So, you know, what's American interest here? Well, America is sort of been cheerleading Hong Kong, you know, from the outset. Now, the distinction here is that, and this moves into the question about Puerto Rico, Taiwan is, you know, has treaties with the United States. When the nationalists fled China, they went to Taiwan. So this is under Chiang Kai-shek. When Mao and the communists took control of mainland China, the nationalists sort of all regrouped on the island of Taiwan, and Taiwan signed a protection pact with the United States. So an attack on Taiwan is going to be met by force of treaty with it treated as an attack on the United States. So Taiwan is in its own kind of separate boat. Hong Kong has been a British protectorate for years. It was part of the British Empire. The United States doesn't have, it has economic ties to Taiwan, but and social and cultural ties, but no treaty status the same way Taiwan does. So by the way, Taiwan was the fourth tiger, I think. You know, so it's interesting. So the United States, if you're kind of looking at it, say, well, what happens if China cracks down? What would the U.S. do? Well, it would not be automatic, as we assume it would be in the case of Taiwan, where the United States would definitely be militarily involved in some level. It's not clear what would happen. And, you know, the British, as I said, have stronger historic ties than the United States does. Now, it takes us to Puerto Rico. Now, Puerto Rico does have an official relationship with the United States. They're not a state, right? There's not a 51st state. Although, if you ever, you know, if you ever want to have a bar bet about what the 51st state is going to be, there's a decent chance it's going to, well, I guess you could say D.C. might incorporate as a state, but Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is a territory, and so officially, Puerto Ricans are citizens of the United States. So they can come and go as they please. They're treated, they have the full rights of citizens, but Puerto Rico has no representation in U.S. government. It's interesting, as we approach the 2020 primaries and caucuses, both the Republicans and Democrats have primaries in Puerto Rico. So for extra political circumstances, Puerto Rico is treated as another state, as is the Virgin Islands and a couple of other territories. So it's not a state, but it's not an independent country the way other countries. It actually has a very special association with the United States. So I was looking at some information on Puerto Rico and exactly why these strong, strong protests are going on. I know the proximate cause is easy enough. Richard Rosello, who's the governor of Puerto Rico, was caught. There were tapes of him talking and then emails released where he said some very misogynistic, sexist, anti-LGBTQ stuff in official and semi-official conversations over the last 18 months. So basically, he said a bunch of stuff that's gotten him in very hot water. That's the proximate cause. But some background information to let you know why, you know, he's got some real problems beyond that. The U.S. territory, I'm quoting here from an article in Politico, the U.S. territory is drowning in debt to the tune of roughly $70 billion, that's with the B, dollars. Roughly 40% of the island residents living in poverty while government spending is out of control. This is from the article. Puerto Rico defaulted on its monthly debt for the first time in 2015. 2 years later, the territory filed for bankruptcy, the largest U.S. bankruptcy claim for a government entity in history. And as the economy gets worse, Puerto Ricans leave the island, meaning that the government has less tax revenue to pay the bills. And then Hurricane Maria made everything much worse. So that's the background here with respect to Puerto Rico and why the situation is so dire and there's so much anxiety anyway. And then the governor, and it's a governor, it's not a president, but it's an elected position. The governor's response is that, well, I'm not going to resign, but I'm not going to run for re-election. I'm going to concentrate on helping the people of Puerto Rico. Okay.
Yeah, that hadn't been going too well. Yeah.
Did you go to Puerto Rico for the conference a couple years ago?
No, I went a few years back. I know the Southern Political Science Association went to Puerto Rico a couple years ago, and I think this was to go in 2020, and my thinking was I really do not want to spend my Puerto Rican vacation looking at pasty political scientists walking around. So I said, you all go and have a good time. I'll go later. But it's part of the U.S. You don't need a passport to go to Puerto Rico. It's part of the U.S. But you will realize you are in a completely different location, primarily Spanish speaking. And it's one of the things that Puerto Rico has is, does it want to become a state? Does it want to stay as a Commonwealth? Or does it want independence? Like, there's a really big fight about what is the future of Puerto Rico. And do you have these fights over where does it stand in relation to the U.S.? Then on top of that, you have really a decade of mismanagement. Part of it has been internal mismanagement. Part of it, you can argue, has been because of Congress's actions have led to this. But it's been poorly mismanaged. There are 21 states in the U.S. with a smaller population than Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico would rank as, I guess, number 37 in GDP if it was a state in the U.S., but with 40% of the people living in poverty, there's a clear problem here. And a lot of the arguments have been put forth, or the policies that have been put forward, is that there is money coming through Puerto Rico, but the Puerto Rican people are not getting that money. And so with all of these problems going on, with hurricane, you also had Zika, where Puerto Rico was hit by the Zika virus, then Hurricane Maria. And so there's all of these things just compounded on top of each other. And then with this coming up on part of the governor, it was really the straw that broke the camel's back. They were already very upset. And this was like, just made it clear, like, okay, you are a complete and utter, or you're a buffoon and you don't know what you're doing. And so everything we thought about you, we've justified. And so now we want action. He probably will resign, but they are negotiating. So it's usually what people always say is like I won't run, but I won't resign. It's usually a negotiation tactic of, okay, how will my exit take place? And it's just another case of things going poorly for Puerto Rico, and it's not really clear how long it will take for the island to really get back on some level of stability.
Yeah, and the third place we'd like to talk about, and I'll sort of talk about why these things kind of group together, is Iran. So in the case of China, you have a country that's sort of economically developed, where the United States has, you know, an interest, but we're primarily kind of a wait and see. And to the extent we have an interest, it's economic and then, I guess, sort of ideological in some sense, you know, facilitating democracy, protecting democratic parts of the world, you know, especially historically at the when there are communist incursions. Now, that situation's changed since the end of the Cold War, but it's still kind of there, right? And we do have these treaties and other agreements to protect places like Taiwan, and so we're sort of sympathetic to Hong Kong. But that's kind of the least relevant. Puerto Rico is very close, and in fact, you know, Democrats would love to make Puerto Rico a state, I think, even though the economic cost could be quite high, because historically, Puerto Rico has been a pretty democratic place. The current governor is democratic. And so at the very least, Puerto Rico looks and says, like, one, maybe two representatives, two senators. This is sort of a good deal for us. Republicans are somewhat skeptical for the same reason. But the Puerto Ricans have not voted for independence. They've had an opportunity to do so, and they voted it down a couple times. Although polls I've seen lately indicate that sentiment has changed. Maybe because 40% of people left Puerto Rico in the last 10, 15 years. So that might be part of it. Might just be the, you know, people who were there want independence, and it might be that sentiment has changed. The third place is Iran. And Iran connects up to something we'll talk a lot about in the third module that we're going to release in a little while. That's when we start talking about foreign policy. As you probably know, the Obama administration negotiated not a treaty but an executive agreement with the Iranians. We also got the British, the Russians, all the Europeans came along. We all had this agreement with the Iranians. The Iranians were going to slow down their nuclear program for 10 years. So they weren't going to continue to develop their nuclear program, which we assume is sort of a pathway towards nuclear weaponry. They were going to slow that down for 10 years. And in exchange, we were going to drop all these economic sanctions that we had on the Iranians. A lot of the, kind of good things for the Iranians were front-loaded. The Republicans never liked this. Even some Democrats weren't real crazy about this as a deal. It was not negotiated as a treaty. It was an executive agreement. And when Donald Trump became president, he basically said, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. So part of what I want to mention is the sort of question of presidential, the president's commander-in-chief. The president has increased his authority throughout the years. If you look at the Constitution, Article 2, the president's formal authorities, there's not very many of them, not very extensive. The Congress is clearly the dominant branch of government. But over time, especially after the Great Depression and after the Second World War, the president has become more and more prominent as a policymaker. And that has been particularly true with respect to foreign policy. So in the case of Iran, the Obama administration wanted the deal. They basically made the deal, even though, and they thought it was going to be problematic to get it through the Senate. So they didn't go through the Senate. They didn't negotiate a treaty. They simply signed an executive agreement. And when it looked like Hillary Clinton was going to be elected, that wasn't going to be a problem. But she lost, and then Donald Trump undid that executive agreement. The Trump administration put economic sanctions back in place against the Iranians. They've had others who have helped. Not the Russians basically have not come back on board, but the British and some other countries have put some restrictions, economic sanctions, back on the Iranians, and the Iranian economy has really struggled. So what's happened lately? Well, the Iranians have kind of stepped up some aggressive activities in the Straits of Hormuz, which is a critical port area. British and American tankers go through that region, and the Iranians have basically said that they consider that Iranian territory. And if the United States continues to be aggressive in pursuing sanctions, and in particular what the proximate cause of the standoff with the British was that the British seized an Iranian tanker that the British said was getting oil and perhaps something beyond oil to Syria, to the Syrian regime, which is against United Nations sanctions and against British policy. The British seized that vessel, so the Iranians responded by seizing two British vessels. And if you guys have seen the footage, haven't seen the footage, you should. The Iranians basically send these helicopters up and drop them down onto these British tankers and take over the British tankers. And as of today, those British tankers are still, being held by the Iranians. The Iranians have also been aggressive with some American ships. A couple days ago, the Iranians said they'd captured 17 spies, they're nationals, so they're Iranians, but they claim they were recruited by the CIA. The United States says, we don't know what you're talking about, but the Iranians have said they're possibly going to execute these people. So the situation has gotten very tense. It's possible there's a lot of posturing going on, that the Iranians are, kind of taking a more aggressive posture to try to negotiate from a position of more strength to get the Americans to reduce some of these economic sanctions. But so that's where we are. It's a long-winded way to put it, but the question is, is the United States going to get a treaty or an executive agreement with the Iranians now that the Obama agreement is basically off the table? So,
yeah, and it's the sad thing about it is that the Obama agreement was short-lived, and considering we have another election coming up, this one could be short-lived as well. It's one of the problems with executive agreements or executive orders is that, they are not necessarily permanent, that they could be repealed when the next president comes in. And so that could undercut a lot of things. And I remember when the agreement first came out, a lot of people were opposed to it, and they kept asking, well, have you read it? Well, no. And so there's a lot of confusion about what's in this agreement, because a lot of people just came out and automatically opposed it without actually knowing what was in it. As the details have come out, you've kind of seen kind of the decisions that were made. Whether or not they were the right decisions or not, it was, I guess, in some ways try to alleviate or try to prevent some type of hostilities from building. Now the hostilities are building. Again, you saw last month, President Trump, there was a planned strike against Iran that President Trump called off. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward as we see this area where there's a great deal of turmoil. And basically it's been a place of kind of a lack of balance or a lot of turmoil for the past, probably 40 or 50 years.
40 or 50 is being generous. Yeah. I go back a couple hundred.
Yeah.
But at any rate, the British are involved, the French to a certain extent, and the Israelis. And, I think the wild card here are the Israelis. I think the Israelis on their own, left to their own devices, would have no problem, launching an airstrike or missile strike against Iranian assets. That would be very difficult internationally. There are a lot of countries that would not go along with that. The Iranians would go ape. In the United States, there is one of the things you've seen with the more progressive elements of the Democratic Party lately is they're not as pro-Israel as the United States has been historically. And I think this would be a real problem. I think Republicans, by and large, would support more aggressive activity against the Iranians. Democrats, much less so, and in particular, if it involved the United States directly, it would be extremely controversial. But even if it involved the Israelis, I think this would be a big issue. So again, this is foreign policy, and we're a class in American government, but we did want to emphasize that, this question about sort of economic ties with Hong Kong and ideological ties with the Puerto Ricans, and Puerto Rico with this, kind of interesting territorial status and the long-term possibility that Puerto Rico becomes a state at some point. And then in the case of the Iranians, it deals directly with the expansion of presidential authority and limited authority by Congress, or, Congress not necessarily negotiating treaties the way they used to historically. All right, so a couple final topics we just want to hit on. Texas elections, I'll be brief here. We mentioned last week that the state legislature, 150 House seats in the state of Texas, that the Republican majority has decreased, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in 2020. At the congressional level, so not the state legislature, but the Texas contingent that goes to Washington, interestingly, a couple of very, very high-profile races are on, basically, I would say out of the 435 House races, you probably have 30 or 40 that are really going to be competitive in the next cycle. There's just not that many because of the way the districts are drawn, because things have sorted out over the last 10 years or so. But there are a couple of them. Of those 30 or 40, three or four of them are going to be in Texas. 23, which is a district that runs almost all the way across West Texas to, basically El Paso, Will Hurd is a Republican. He's won that seat three times in a row by basically five votes each time. I mean, they're really, really close elections. Will Hurd also came out strongly against President Obama's tweets lately. So Will Hurd Trump's tweets. Hurd has done that. He's gone against Obama, even though he's a Republican, several times. Partly, I think that's just the way he is, but it's also his constituency. That is a swing district, Texas 23. The interesting one this week, Texas 21. The Republican incumbent is Chip Roy. Chip Roy voted to, or basically stopped the relief bill, continued relief in the aftermath of the hurricanes in Houston. Chip Roy held up congressional aid and services in response. This is basically kind of a long-term response to rebuild Houston after the hurricanes. And Chip Roy in 21 stopped that. And he said it was because there's problems with the way it's been delivered. So he framed it as helpful, but the headlines were, he's keeping money out of the pockets of Houston after the hurricane. That's not necessarily the posture you want to be in. So Wendy Davis, who ran for governor a few years ago, very famously took she was a representative from Fort Worth, a state senator rather from Fort Worth, ran a very credible race for governor, was beaten by Abbott, but she's a very high profile Democrat. She's running against Chip Roy. So that District 21 race could be very interesting. And then on the Senate side, United States Senate, as you all probably know, John Cornyn is running for re-election, Republican from Texas. And he has got not only MJ Hager, who ran a very good race in a state house district last time around, but Royce West, a guy named Edwards, and Chris Bell. So he's got four Democratic opponents. So four Democrats already lined up to contest the primary in March of 2020 in an effort to take on John Cornyn. Now, what you don't have running against Cornyn is you don't have Beto O'Rourke, and you don't have either of the Castros. Still, pretty solid, pretty credible candidates for the Democrats next time around. So that's our little Texas election and politics.
Yeah, I think with the close election between O'Rourke and Cruz, Democrats feel they may have a chance of winning a statewide election. Pardon me, I think it's more of a contingency in the sense that there were a lot of people who are not happy with Ted Cruz. I think John Cornyn is not seen as much of a lightning rod as Ted Cruz is. So there's a little bit more of an uphill battle. But also, I think John Cornyn has ingratiated himself with the powers that be in the GOP, where he does have leadership roles, to where you should expect to see the GOP come out very strongly and support him. Where you may see people who kind of cringe at supporting Ted Cruz, they might be more likely to support John Cornyn. So I think he'll be good. I just hope they don't run the Big John ad again, because that was just so sad.
Cornyn works real hard. It's interesting. His numbers with Republicans aren't very good, which is ironic because, you know, Ted Cruz's numbers are really great with Republicans, even though Cruz has nowhere near the experience or sort of long-term credentials as Cornyn. And Ted Cruz has some real likability problems in the state of Texas. And yet, you know, he runs pretty strong. But I agree that Cornyn has worked very long and hard. He's worked his tail off to sort of develop a following in South Texas. And you know, but he just doesn't seem to have the same kind of odd charisma as Cruz, although... Yes. You know, a lot of people would balk at the term charisma. Okay, so Professor McDaniel wanted, as we were talking about what to talk about this week, he wanted to talk about a big pharma, right? So what do you got for us on pharmaceuticals and...
So as we know, many are aware of the opioid crisis and response to it. One of the things, if you've been looking at the Washington Post has been running a number of articles about the role that pharmaceutical companies have played in really advancing the opioid crisis. While pharmaceutical companies have argued that they played no role in this, there's growing evidence showing that they were pushing the use of opioids at a rate that was really higher than recommended, or in many ways false advertising. That even though they knew it was addictive, kind of downplaying how addictive it was. This is very similar to what we saw about 20 or 30 years ago regarding the cigarette manufacturers. And one of the things that's important to note is that the U.S. is a very litigious society, meaning that a lot of things are settled in the courts. And so if we're dealing with issues of discrimination, things like that, you don't necessarily see laws being passed, but really suits are coming out. And so a lot of the policies that we see coming about are the ways in which people try to prevent future negative actions from coming about is through using the courts to seek redress for past actions, but also to control future actions. So I think one of the things to pay attention to is that while we talk about maybe Congress not being as active as we would like for it to be in passing certain policies, a lot of action is taking place in the courts. And so when we talk about the U.S. being a very litigious society, it's because we see a lot of the policies taking shape within the courts as opposed to within the legislature. And where we're seeing a lot of the action being taken place in response to the opioid crisis and the role of pharmaceutical companies in the opioid crisis is in the courts. You're seeing states such as Oklahoma make certain rulings, receive funds. You're seeing counties sue. You're seeing states come together to sue. I think Ohio is launching one right now. One of the major problems, though, is that with some of the suits that have been coming out, there are concerns about how a jury may award a state or a county a large amount of money, but the judge may say, well, that may be too much, so it may bring it down some. But a lot of what's going on is the states are suing, saying, look, you caused this problem, so you will pay to help us fix this problem, to pay for treatment centers, things like that. And again, you're seeing that a lot of pharmaceutical companies and owners of pharmaceutical companies, the families associated with them that were one time social darlings, are now becoming social pariahs where nobody wants to be associated with them. They may have donated money to museums. Their names are now being taken off. And that we're seeing really in many ways we saw the reaction to the link between lung cancer and smoking and going after cigarette manufacturers. We've seen the same thing going on with pharmaceutical companies regarding the opioid crisis.
Excellent. All right, so just a couple of notes. Boris Johnson is the new prime minister, will be sworn as the new prime minister of Great Britain. Boris is an interesting name for a British prime minister.
He was the former mayor of London, if I remember properly.
I believe that's right. And he's a member of the Conservative Party. One interesting difference between the United States and Great Britain is if you are the leader of the majority party in Great Britain, you're the prime minister, right? So there's not a president. The executive in Great Britain is a creature of the legislature. This is a very, you know, the huge distinction between the United States and Great Britain. And then John Paul Stevens, former Supreme Court justice, passed away 99 years of age. He had a pretty good run.
Yes, yeah.
And was important as a liberal voice on the court. If you get a chance to watch, he's lying in repose right now, which is the prerogative of former justices of the Supreme Court. His clerks take turn standing vigil. I believe that Stevens had close to 100 clerks during his time. And they basically kind of rotate, but there is constantly a group of former clerks standing basically at attention as John Paul Stevens lies in repose. Supreme Court, current Supreme Court members have already, you know, paid their respects. So it's you know, we don't have the same kind of pomp and circumstance as the Brits and some other countries do. But what we do have is actually very kind of cool and very democratic and very dignified. So if you get a chance to watch part of those services and ceremonies, it's always kind of it's a nice thing to do at a time when it's hard to watch American politics sometimes. Our circumstances, as I said, aren't quite as you know, official and as royal as the Brits, but what we do pretty well. So if you get a chance to watch that, very important figure in American political history. So with that, have a good week. Maybe we'll get a cold front moving through pretty soon. Knock that heat down. In the meantime, hit your deadlines, take advantage of the resources in the class, come to office hours, and we'll see you next week.